Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 397. This week, the questions are taken from guide 463 on the Grampus class submarines of the Royal Navy and the Wednesday video on naval engineering, how exactly you should choose your engines. So let's begin. Nigel Smith asks, I'm interested in how underwater broadside-fixed torpedo launcher tubes work. So depending on the size of the ship, these can take a few different forms. If you're talking about very early tubes, or you're talking about fixed tubes on small manoeuvrable craft like torpedo boats and such like, although obviously very often they have above water launchers, but occasionally some of the early ones have below water launchers, then it's a case of you're aiming the entire ship. And to be fair, at that early stage of things, torpedoes are short range enough that that's probably fine, because you're going to be so close that just a general kind of roughly in the right direction is going to get you at least close to the target. However, as torpedoes advance, and of course you install them on larger ships, that's not really as possible as it used to be. Now, at that point, you can have two main kinds of underwater torpedo launch tubes. Most of them are fixed. Some of them can actually be trained in and of themselves. But regardless, either way, they will rely to a certain extent on the gyroscope guidance of a torpedo to correct any necessary angle that needs to be made. So let's say that you are theoretically broadside onto your target, but of course your target may be traveling in the same direction as you because you've matched course with it, but it may be, let's say, 1,000 yards ahead. So the actual launch angle is somewhat ahead of you rather than just straight perpendicular. But if your launch tube is straight perpendicular, this is a problem. But then you set the gyro to say, okay, well, once you launch, I want you to turn, let's say, 35 degrees to port and then straighten out. And torpedoes can do this. You do run slight risk of the torpedo beginning to circle wildly, but that's just par for the course when it comes to early 20th century torpedoes. And so with a fixed tube, you can still fire at quite a wide array of angles. And, well, at that point, they act pretty much like submarine torpedo tubes do, which are also fixed tubes. It's just the submarine still, to a certain extent, works on the point submarine in direction of the enemy, although, again, with gyro launches as well. Now, the other interesting thing, of course, is that if you were to launch a broadside torpedo into the stream of water coming past a ship, not only have you got the general fact that obviously a ship going in a certain direction means the water's going to be coming past at a certain rate, but you've also got the flow that's flowing right alongside the hull, which is going to be somewhat more turbulent, and depending on exactly where the launcher is and how the hull is designed and so forth, can actually be going significantly faster than the general waters around you. And obviously that poses a huge risk to, you know, at best ripping the torpedo off in a direction you don't want it to go, at worst just slamming the torpedo against the side of the tube and causing it to break up, run down the side of your ship and potentially explode somewhere in the vicinity of your stern, which is definitely not a good thing. And so a lot of the tubes would have something like what you see here, this kind of little extendable arm. And the idea of these was that the torpedo would run along them as they were launched. And sometimes they were just guidance arms giving a bit of shelter. As you can see here, this one's also kind of a bit of a launch rail. But the idea is essentially that this gets the torpedo out past that boundary flow of water out into the more general water, at which point the torpedo goes off on its merry way. So these would obviously be extended at the time of launch and retracted when the torpedo had finished launching. Then, depending on whether or not you've got these, and to be honest, almost regardless in some cases, there are also issues about the strength of the launcher, how much compressed air is it using, or if it's using hydraulics, or if it's using one of these arms, how effective that arm is. So with some ships, you could only launch those broadside torpedoes below a certain speed. But with other ships, perhaps with more powerful launchers and better guidance arms, you could launch them at higher speeds. And as speeds went up and up and up, obviously these problems became exponentially greater. And regardless of other factors regarding whether or not you would actually have an underwater torpedo tube set up or not, the rising speed of ships was starting to put paid to these things, because, for example, on Renown, Repulse and Hood, during their design considerations, when they were looking at potentially putting in underwater torpedo tubes, one of the things that came up was, well, if they're running up over 30 knots, basically there's nothing we can do to actually ensure a successful broadside torpedo launch. They would have to slow down, which obviously, if they're battle cruisers, isn't necessarily the best of ideas. So this is one of the reasons why, when you look at Hood, she actually has above water torpedo launchers, because they're not subject to quite the same constraints. Dog Bertius asks, what do you think led to such a high loss rate within the Grampus class? Was the design flawed, or is it simply a function of their mission taking them much closer to enemy bases and areas of operation, and therefore them being at greater risk of detection? I think it's a mixture of things. Firstly, of course, it's not a particularly large class of submarines. There's only six of them. But the majority of the losses, I think, are caused by the nature of their mission. You know, a mine-laying mission, you have to get very, very close to enemy ports, which means you're in very close range for their anti-submarine sweeps. They're going to know the areas, they're going to be guarding the areas very closely, and it also tends to be shallow water, which removes a lot of the safety of a submarine. You know, one of the safest things for a submarine to do in World War II when under attack is to dive deep and then evade. If the water's only 50 to 100 foot deep, you can't do that. And also in certain circumstances, it means that even if you're underwater, you may well be seen, either just because you can't go too deep, so the sunlight going through the water still highlights you, or you get silhouetted against the seabed. But I think broadly speaking, you can divide the losses into two sets. So Cachalot and Narwhal are lost to Italian torpedo boats and German aircraft, respectively. Those two, I think, would fall under the general category of just unlucky. This is, you know, that's the kind of losses that happen to various submarines at various points, kind of to be expected in war. They're caught on the surface while in transit, and they aren't able to evade fast enough or successfully enough to survive. But then when you look at the other three, so that were lost, that'd be Grampus, Porpoise and Seal, they are all lost in the process of conducting mine-laying missions or very shortly thereafter. And that is, you know, they're big submarines, they're very in close to enemy positions. That's a very high-risk position to be in, and, well, for those three, it doesn't pay off in the end, although obviously Porpoise especially almost makes it through to the end of the war. She's sunk in 1945. Rorqual, of course, goes through very much similar circumstances, but just has better luck. Almirante Brown asks, would the Axis have benefited from a fleet submarine analogous to the UK's Thames or River class with its high surface and submerged speed? I would think that early in the war, a German submarine with similar characteristics to said class would be able to mount a high-speed surface attack on convoys at night and, if necessary, escape underwater at 10 knots. Which of the Axis powers would most benefit from that kind of submarine, and how would it be deployed to have made best use of such attributes? Yes, I think the Axis could have benefited from a river-type submarine. Of course, it's quite a large submarine, so they wouldn't have been able to build quite as many of them, perhaps. Well, the Japanese might, because they built a ton of big submarines anyway, but I don't think the Japanese would have benefited the most, because, well, they had a bunch of big, fast submarines. Maybe not exact analogues, but let's face it, the Japanese submarine campaign, outside of a few rather interesting successes, wasn't all that much to write home about. I think the nation which would have benefited the most would be the Kriegsmarine. And you might be thinking, oh, yeah, well, of course, the Germans, U-boats, they would have benefited quite a lot. Or you might be thinking, oh, hang on, no, the Germans were really good at U-boats. Why would they need this thing? Well, there's one very specific reason, and it's the underwater part of that top speed. You see, ASDIC, which was obviously very important for the British to be able to lock down and then attack and sink various submarines, degrades in performance as you go faster and faster. And even modern-day submariners, or indeed anti-submarine warfare-trained people, basically anyone who runs a military-grade sonar will know, the faster you go, the harder it is for your sonar to work properly, whether it be passive or active. Of course, an awful lot of work has gone into things so that these days you can find some ships or submarines that can go quite quickly and still use their sonar to a reasonable degree, but there is still some degradation. But back in the days of World War II, ASDIC generally was held to be pretty good up to a speed of around about 8 knots, and the minute you started going faster than 8 knots, you started to have issues with its performance. And as it so happened, the top speed of most common German submarines, the Type 7s and the Type 9s, was, generally speaking, around 7 to 7.5 knots underwater, which meant that the absolute fastest they would go, outside of obviously a few unusual cases where they might be able to push things a little bit further, didn't help them all that much because the ASDIC could still find a lock onto them perfectly well. If, however, you, say, replaced a certain number of Type 9s with river-class type submarines who are capable of 10 knots underwater, while it's only a 2-2.5 knot speed increase compared to what a Type 9 might be able to do, it does push the ASDIC operators into a realm where their equipment's performance is starting to be somewhat degraded, making it harder to lock on. And of course, since you're now going at 10 knots underwater, you're going somewhat faster, somewhat further. So that means if a torpedo launch is detected, for example, or a periscope is spotted, and your 16-knot flower class comes racing out, maybe it's bad weather and speed's reduced to maybe 13 or 14 knots, if you're able to make off at 10 knots, you're going to be much further away from the initial point of contact when that corvette arrives than you would be if you were in a submarine that can only do about 7 knots underwater, which means it's much harder to find you. And when they try and find you, they're trying to find you with degraded sonar operating conditions, and they've got a much larger area to search, which would make the submarines far more survivable and also far more able to reposition, because it would also mean that, at least for slow convoys, you'd actually have a very slight speed advantage over them, even underwater, which would mean that, batteries allowing, you could launch an attack on a convoy and then immediately turn to, well, I'd say race ahead, gradually catch up with and move ahead of a convoy and launch another attack. Again, something that a Type 7 or a Type 9 can't do without surfacing. So it would give a significant additional operational aspect to the Kriegsmarine submarine arms, which would be very difficult for everybody to counter. NCC638 asks, not strictly a naval question, but more a general maritime history question, if Carpathia had been closer to Titanic that night and had arrived on station, say, an hour before the breakup and final plunge, how many passengers and crew could realistically have been transferred before she slipped beneath the waves? Furthermore, given that the loss of life would have been lessened, what does that mean for the changes in maritime safety regulations that followed? Well, with regards to the second bit, there may have been somewhat less push to revise the safety regs if the majority of people aboard Titanic had survived. Albeit there could still be some push, because some people would be going, well, look, the system works. You know, there were enough boats to save most people, and the seas are trafficked enough that we don't have to worry about things too much because someone will always show up, as is clearly evident in this case. But there would be other people who would argue, well, yeah, if all of that works out, fine. But if you're not lucky enough, like if you're sailing off in slightly less well-travelled waters or the ship hadn't been quite as close, it could have been very, very bad. And of course, any lives that were lost because they weren't able to transfer enough people over would obviously help to strengthen those people who were saying, okay, we need to revise these regulations. So I think there still would have been a push to revise the regs, but it may be a somewhat weaker push, and you may need to wait until one of the other major ocean liner disasters, perhaps one of the major liners that got sunk during the First World War, to kind of push things over the edge. Now, in terms of, you know, how many could Carpathia have saved, based on the number of people who were aboard her at the time, based on her and her rated capacity, Carpathia had about space for about another 1,500 people on top of who was already on board on the voyage where obviously she came to Titanic's rescue, or rescue of some of the passengers at least. Titanic, meanwhile, has around about just over 2,200 people on board total. And of course, now some of those had already lost their lives as the lower sections flooded. But that means that theoretically, Carpathia could take on board a good number of those, but you would still leave about 700 people too many if you managed to take everybody aboard, or at least all the survivors aboard. But with that said, the roughly 2,500 people that Carpathia could take on board, of which about 1,000 she already had on board, that's her rated capacity in terms of, you know, this is how many passengers we think you can transport for a regular voyage. In an emergency, I think adding another 700 odd people to that would be entirely doable. So Carpathia did physically have the capacity to take everyone on board from the Titanic, even if it would be very cramped. Now, as far as how many people could be transferred, well, you're looking at about 60 to 70 people per lifeboat, depending on the lifeboat, because obviously the lifeboats come in slightly different shapes and sizes. Carpathia is supposed to have had about 20 lifeboats of her own. And then, of course, there's the ones on Titanic, although some on Titanic weren't entirely accessible. And now, how many could you transfer if you have an hour before the ship sinks? Well, at the very end, obviously, you're not going to be able to move anyone because the Titanic does start to shift downwards quite quickly towards the very end. But I think the best system that they could have arrived at, I mean, if you look at this picture, you can roughly count the number of davits, would have been to keep all the operational Titanic lifeboats that hadn't already been launched at that point on their davits, so you can lower and raise them, and then bring Carpathia as close as you think is safe to Titanic, so maybe a few hundred yards if you're really skilled, and then lower all of Carpathia's boats, barring as many as can be hung from the davits on the side closest to Titanic. And the reason I'd say that is that what you would then do is you'd have a mixture of Titanic boats that are already in the water, plus a good number of Carpathia boats, and you would then load people into the boats aboard Titanic that were still on the davits, lower them down to the water. They would then transfer to boats that are already free-floating in the water, which would then be rowed over to Carpathia. You would then transfer to, again, to the boats that are on Carpathia's davits, which would then be hauled up and you'd be taken on board. And I think that would admittedly run some risks because you're doing two transfers per set of survivors, but it would be far, far quicker than lowering a boat off of the davits on Titanic, detaching it, rowing it over, trying to work out if you could reattach it to Carpathia's davits and hauling it up again. So, you know, if you want to save lives, I think that this shuttle system is probably the best way of doing things. As the bow of Titanic gets closer and closer to the water, you could also have a system where perhaps some of the fitter passengers would go down to the bow and essentially step off or take a very short jump from the sinking bow of the Titanic. And you could have some boats in that vicinity because you know, if you've got, let's say, 15 boats from Carpathia plus a few from Titanic already in the water, the number of boats that you're going to be elevating and dropping down on the davits is on both sides is going to be somewhat limited. So you obviously you'd have some boats picking people up who are already in the water, you'd have and then other boats picking people up from around about the bow and getting them across. You could also potentially put ropes and nets if they have them aboard Carpathia for some of the fitter passengers to try and climb, although that could be quite dangerous. So perhaps that'll be a last minute thing. So each transfer, assuming that you have, let's say, five davits down one side of Carpathia in operation, would be about 300 people that you could take on board. Now, how many of those transfers could you do in an hour? It's difficult to work out, but it's generally estimated that it took about 5 minutes to lower a boat. It might take a little bit less time if you let it go a bit faster, and you could obviously it would take a bit, maybe a bit longer to raise it. If you've only got a few hundred yards to row, you could potentially do that in 5 minutes or so. There is a longer period of actually loading the boats, but if everything gets a bit more organized, maybe that could be accelerated. So I'd say if you're being optimistic, you could do maybe 4 transfers, pessimistically 2 or 3. That's full transfers before the ship goes down or it becomes too unsafe to get close to it. Maybe a bit more. So let's say, and bear in mind that's based on 60 people per boat, but it might be overloading boats and you'd have other boats coming in. This is talking about purely the davit down, transfer again and davit up again. So let's say you could bring on roughly 1,000 to 1,200 people via the direct transfer method in that hour. And that's including, you know, random boats popping along, perhaps coming around the other side and being raised on the other davits of Carpathia. Now, that leaves about half of the people aboard Titanic still stuck aboard Titanic. However, you have the total of about 20 boats aboard Carpathia, plus the boats from Titanic that would either be in the water or still on the davits. So as it became clear that the end was approaching, if you actually add up all those numbers and multiply by their total capacity, it turns out that you actually theoretically have enough capacity in the Titanic boats that hit the water and all of Carpathia's boats if they're in the water to hold everyone else who was on Titanic with some room to spare. So obviously this would depend quite a lot on judging when Titanic was finally going down and how safe you wanted to be. Obviously boats would have to pull away at a certain point to avoid being sucked down. But in theory, with a little bit of luck, it would be possible to transfer enough people over to Carpathia quickly enough that when it becomes clear that the ship is about to go down, that's Titanic, if everyone who's left makes it onto the various boats that are in the water and Carpathia, let's say, puts down all of her boats, you would in theory be able to bring across practically everyone. Now, of course, it's not going to be a complete salvation because, of course, as we know, some people had already drowned by even an hour before Carpathia shows up. And in the final part, as the ship is going down, some people are going to jump into the sea, some people are going to die from hypothermic shock, etc., etc. But in a best case scenario, I reckon you could probably get away with saving maybe 2,000 out of the 2,200 aboard, maybe a few more as well. There would then be quite a while as Carpathia fetched up all the boats and brought them aboard. But hey, you know, that's better than drowning horribly in an icy North Atlantic. Brendan Buersdorf asks, how effective were conventional bombs against submarines and what tactics were used to actually make them work? Because in the video on the Grampus class and in a number of other videos, I've noticed quite a few submarines were bombed on the surface. Bombs could be very effective against surface submarines. In fact, when they are surface, they could be more effective than depth charges, because of course depth charges have to generally be set to explode at a certain depth. So there are cases where U-boats were depth charged while they're on the surface. The depth charge lands a direct hit and then rolls off of the submarine because it hasn't reached its detonation depth, sinks, and then it explodes and sometimes obviously does damage to the submarine. Whereas a bomb, a high explosive bomb, which tend to be the type you'd lob at a sub, would hit and explode. That's kind of its job. So in that respect, bombs could be more effective. You did have some issues in that the average bomb that would be dropped generally would contain somewhat less explosive charge than the average depth charge. But there's still a fair amount of explosive on board, and of course a general purpose bomb would have significantly more heavy fragments than a depth charge, which is designed primarily as a big packet of explosive designed to sink by shockwaves rather than fragments. So if you could land a hit or a very near miss with a bomb, you stood a pretty good chance of putting a hole in it that would either sink it or at least prevent it from diving, at which point you could follow up with further bombs. Now, of course, a submarine is a relatively small target compared to most ships, but on the other hand, it's also, relatively speaking, somewhat slow moving. And while they do have, as the war goes on, progressively fiercer anti-aircraft defences, they're still nothing compared to the anti-aircraft defences of a full-on warship. So you treat the bombing mission pretty much the same way you attack almost anything else, but perhaps with more effort to try and close the distance on the sub. Now, obviously, again, there's certain degrees of danger involved, but for example, if the sub is diving, the anti-aircraft positions might not be manned. And even if they are manned, They're usually relatively concentrated, even on late war era U-boats, at which point if you're, you know, in a small, fast aircraft like a fighter or a single-engined patrol aircraft like an Avenger, you might be able to pull off a dive attack regardless. And if you're in something larger like a Sunderland or a Catalina, you can probably actually engage on the way in with your nose guns and stand a fairly good chance of suppressing the enemy's anti-aircraft fire. Of course, the enemy gets a vote as well, you might get hit. The single biggest weakness of bombs, of course, is that if a submarine is in the process of diving and manages to dive before you manage to drop bombs on it significantly, once the submarine passes through a very shallow depth, because the bomb is likely to detonate on or very near the surface, the submarine then becomes immune to your attacks. Whereas if you have a depth charge or of some description, you can continue to attack the sub pretty much till you lose contact. Doug JB asks, from a casual reading, it can appear that the Royal Navy put turbines on HMS Dreadnought and never looked back. It was turbines, turbines, turbines all the livelong day. How accurate is that? Were there any further debates about using turbines compared to any other propulsion system? And did any notable voices advocate against turbines? For major warships, yeah, pretty much. Once the Royal Navy had gone in with turbines on Dreadnought destroyers and so forth around about 1905-1906 period, they never really looked back. Turbines offered just too many advantages. Yes, early turbines did have some disadvantages in that they ran at too high speeds to be ideally efficient. But for the Royal Navy, the other efficiencies you got in terms of speed versus power put in, and, well, just also a more pleasant engineering environment, were more than enough, considering that any, you know, potential issues around, oh, we need to find some coal to re-coal ourselves, or later oil, could be made up with the fact that, well, we happen to have the world's largest network of coaling bases, so that's fine. Whereas for perhaps the US, which has to think considerably more about going across the Pacific, where even if they do have a few coaling bases, they're extremely far apart, it was somewhat more of a problem to think about. However, this is only the case for major surface combatants, so destroyers, cruisers, and battleships, battle cruisers, etc. There were some occasional debates about, oh, well, you know, for efficiency wise, do we want to go for vertical triple expansion engines again? It never really got very far. Turboelectric drive was, of course, investigated at one point. They decided it was just a bit too big and heavy, amongst other things. Obviously, diesels went into subs, but there was never really anything to look back on as far as the Royal Navy was concerned, especially once geared turbines came about. Where you did see the recurrence of vertical triple expansion engines would be on smaller vessels, i.e. non-frontline combatants that weren't with the Grand Fleet, things like the Flower-class sloops of World War One. Obviously, those things didn't need to go particularly fast, and there was a huge industrial base for the production of vertical triple expansion engines, so they had them. And as time went on, this just became more and more cemented in, because the further and further you got into the Dreadnought arms race, and the more and more ships that the Royal Navy had that were turbine-powered, not only did that have the various speed advantages and so forth that they were looking for, but it also meant that if you were going to argue for a reversion to ships with vertical triple expansion engines or whatever, you would be arguing to put a ship into the fleet that was discongruous with the performance of the rest of the fleet. And obviously that, you know, the ratio of ships that you could perform alongside versus the ones that would just outrun you would grow larger and larger and larger every single year, so it became less and less attractive. BK Zhong asks, why did nobody else use the French forced circulation boiler designs? Such efficiency seems like something everyone would have wanted. Two broad factors were involved. Firstly is the fact that, as I mentioned before when discussing them, forced circulation boilers do have some downsides, including the fact that they are less reliable, therefore also need a lot more maintenance, and they cost significantly more, which certainly in the early to mid-1930s, coming off the Great Depression, would have significantly influenced some Navy's choices. And, of course, as well as being, you know, a little bit less reliable and a little bit more high maintenance, they are also, therefore, also somewhat more susceptible to battle damage and make the whole engineering plant somewhat more complex. And in a lot of navies, the idea of a safe, reliable engineering plant that almost has its own backups built in held a lot of attractions, as opposed to something that was a little bit more complex and finicky and might randomly break on you. Now, for the French, they took something of a gamble, but it was a qualified gamble because the Indre boilers, the Soral type manufactured by Indre boilers, were of a slightly advanced design compared to the other four circulation boilers that were around in the 1930s. Bear in mind, four circulation boilers hadn't been around that long at that point. So while it was something of a gamble, they were going with the latest and greatest, and you know, it worked out for them pretty well. But for everybody else, if they'd been looking at the rank and file four circulation boilers that were present in the mid-1930s, it would have been wise on balance to perhaps not go with those. Whereas if someone else had independently made the similar kind of advances that Indre had, then maybe that nation would have gone with those boilers as well. Pilot Mix asks, what are the main differences between fuel oil for boilers and fuel oil for diesels? Was diesel fuel in the 1930s the same as modern heavy fuel oil? And did submarines and diesel destroyer escorts have fuel purification systems? So, broadly speaking, fuel oil for steam boilers for warships in World War II was very thick, heavy stuff. You know, Bunker C classically is actually more of a sludge at room temperatures, and needs to be heated in order to become viscous enough to actually feed into the boilers. And in some cases, such as low temperatures or a particularly bad batch of bunker fuel, you can actually cut it into slices and carry it around. I wouldn't, because it's horribly toxic, but you could if you wanted to. Whereas the fuel oil used for diesels by the 1930s... you know, in the 1900s and so forth, diesels ran on all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff. But by the 1930s, the higher performance diesels that were used in things like, say, Admiral Scheer, as seen here, had to be relatively smooth flowing. So they were actual fuel oils at room temperature. So, you know, much like modern diesel. However, the exact composition of what was classified as diesel fuel was not standardized in any way, shape, or form in the 1930s, and so it varied quite significantly, partly based on what you needed it for, and partly based on who was manufacturing it. So if you were looking at German diesel fuel, for instance, there'd be a lot of synthetic fuel derived from coal, whereas in the US, diesel fuel was very heavily derived from petroleum because, well, they had loads of it and they didn't need the additional step of the synthetic production process. So diesel fuel in the 1930s might be similar to modern heavy fuel oil. Depending on who you were sourcing it from, it might be completely different. Now, as far as submarines and diesel-powered destroyer escorts, by that I'm taking you mean American vessels powered by diesel, did they have fuel purification systems? As far as I know, or as far as I'm aware, no, they didn't. At least not in the same way that something like a Deutschland class would have a fuel purification system. There were systems on board in order to ensure that the diesel fuel remained pure, but that was more about trapping and extracting water that may have gotten into the system than it was about just purifying the diesel mix totally. And that's because, well, for the US and certainly to a certain extent the UK as well, you could guarantee the mix of your diesel fuel because you were producing it in exceptionally large amounts. And therefore, unless you had something like water contamination, you didn't really have to worry about refining it further. Whereas for something like the German diesel fuel mix, which was a mix of all sorts of weird and wonderful stuff, not only might the mix vary slightly, you know, on a voyage-by-voyage basis, depending on where you got it from and how much of the various mixtures they had and what they were using at the time, but if you were taking on fuel from ships that you'd captured, obviously you had no idea what mix they might be using, and so you had to standardize it to a certain extent before feeding it into your engines, unless you wanted really weird and potentially horrible things to happen to you. Steve West Swanson asks, how did the Imperial German Navy's use of vertical triple expansion engines over turbines impact their surface fleet during the First World War? Would later German capital ship designs with diesel engines have given good service if they were finished? So there were two significant impacts by the use of vertical triple expansion engines in some of their earlier ships. So this is what the German fleet ostensibly looked like in the run-up to the encounter with the Grand Fleet. This is, as you can probably tell from the bottom right, a German chart. It's a little bit massaged compared to what similar British observations of the fleet were like. But as you can see, one of the immediate things is the Nassaus are right at the back, and the poor old Deutschlands are even further back still. And so first major effect was that the Nassaus, for example, were significantly slower than other people's dreadnoughts, and that meant that the total battle line speed of the High Seas Fleet was several knots slower than, say, the Grand Fleet. And that meant that they were slightly slower to respond to things like first scouting group going, help, the Queen Elizabeths are after us. But the other thing, which isn't quite demonstrated in this chart, as I said, partly because the Germans are just being perhaps a little bit too neat, but develops even more so over the course of the battle, is that when you have to go, okay, forget the fact that, you know, we're technically all trying to just slow down enough so that the Nassaus don't get entirely left behind, as you can see the Deutschlands were being somewhat left behind, even if they cut a corner. Once everyone goes, you know, full power, they start getting left behind even more. And so this is part of the reason that the German fleet formation, while they roughly keep it together, does start to disintegrate in terms of being, you know, a nice neat line, and just becomes a little bit of a mess as the engagement goes on. Because obviously if you've got something like the Koenigs up front going full pelt, they're just going to outpace the Nassaus. And that leaves you with problems in terms of station keeping and the like. Now, in terms of would later German capital ships with diesel engines have given good service if finished, I mean, in theory, there wouldn't be anything wrong with them per se, but with World War I diesel engine power densities, you would either be looking at ships with overly large engineering plants and therefore having to sacrifice armor or armament in order to have a similar top speed to their steam turbine driven counterparts, or you would end up, if you kept everything the same, so you had a proportional armor and armament setup, you'd end up with ships that were slightly slower, which obviously neither of those things are entirely good. The idea, given again the power density specifications that you had for World War I diesels, the idea they had with things like Prince Regent Luitpold there, you can see second from the rear of 6th Division near the top, of having a centerline shaft running on diesel for very efficient cruising at slower speeds, and then the outer two shafts on turbines for high-speed dashes in battle, I think was probably the better idea, given the technology of the time, rather than just trying to go all diesel. Ferdivian Schwalkier, 1669, I think, asks, given that multiple ships would have different efficiencies with turbines, how did a fleet or convoy determine their cruising and battle speeds? Did it affect the composition of formations and task forces? So, broadly speaking, when you have a fleet or a convoy, you would look at it and go, okay, what's the fastest, the slowest ship in this formation can do? And then you would determine things based on that. So for a convoy, obviously merchant ships are generally designed to just run at a constant speed. So in those cases, unless there's a particularly difficult situation going on, like our engine plant is really decrepit, and if we run it at full speed for more than a day, it's going to blow. But in most cases, it would just be a case of, okay, what's the maximum sustainable cruising speed of the slowest ship? It's, I don't know, 12 knots. Okay, right, well, that technically makes us a fast convoy. So guess what, everybody? We're going to be running at 12 knots. And everybody would theoretically know how fast they needed to run their own engines to reach 12 knots. That's somewhat easier because, of course, we're talking about a convoy. When you're talking about a war fleet, however, you have a lot more things to consider. And yes, you would then consider formations and task forces and their composition. I mean, even with a convoy, if you have, let's say, 15 ships that can make at least 12 knots and one ship that can make 8, you're going to tell, sorry, that slow ship, you're going off and waiting for the slow convoy. We're not all slowing down for you. When it came to a fleet, you would have a cruising speed, which everybody should be able to keep to, because that would be well below the average top speed. So it might be, you know, 12 knots, 14 knots, 16 knots, something like that. But then you would have a fast cruising speed, which would be if you needed to close in on something, but you weren't yet going to full battle speed. And then, of course, battle speed would be either, if you were acting as an entire fleet unit, the maximum speed that the slowest ship could do, or if you were split into multiple squadrons or divisions, then it would obviously be the maximum speed that the slowest ship in that division could do, and sometimes not even that. So obviously you would try and group ships of similar performance into various groups, but if you end up with something like, say, the battle cruiser fleet in a pursuit, something like Lion or Tiger is going to significantly outpace an Invincible or Indefatigable class battle cruiser, and they would just be allowed to drop behind somewhat. Whereas in, say, a Grand Fleet battle division, where theoretically the max speed for everybody is 21 knots, unless you're a Revenge class or a QE, then, well, that's roughly what everyone would be doing as a max. But as we see with, for example, the potential engagement with Gerben, with Trowbridge, he decided that his high cruise speed was going to be 2 knots less than what he reckoned the maximum any of his ships could sustain was. So in that case, because they had one troublesome armored cruiser, theoretically all his armored cruisers could make 23 knots, but one of them could only make about 20. So he said, okay, well, my fast cruise speed is going to be 18 knots, 2 knots less, gave him a bit of a margin, with the idea of then being able to bring a couple more knots online for a short period, like battle. And obviously, if necessary, he could go a bit faster than that if he was happy to leave that slow ship somewhat behind. Elite Corsair asks, in the naval melee of Guadalcanal, what other options did Admiral Callahan have to realistically give battle and potentially win? I think there's probably two things he could have done, or rather one thing he could have done and one thing he shouldn't have done. And both of them are relatively small changes, without suggesting, you know, massive, overarching, completely alternate history battle tactics. The first would have been to try and familiarize himself a bit more with the capabilities of radar in the run-up to the battle, and potentially swap out his flagship to a ship that actually had the most modern SG radar. That alone, even if he'd done everything else the way that he did, would have given him a much clearer idea of where the Japanese were, what they were doing, and therefore what his ships were doing, and how best to therefore engage, and perhaps when to engage, perhaps let loose some torpedoes a little bit earlier. The other thing, which would have been a relatively easy change, would have been to either just not send his final order before the battle started, or to send something slightly different. So right before the engagement kicks off, he sends out this completely nonsensical signal of, okay, everybody, you know, lead ship fire at targets on this side, and then the next ship fire on the target to port, and you're sort of sitting there going, what on earth were you thinking, man, with this order? It's a night action. Nobody has any idea exactly which enemy ships can be seen from which of your friendly ships. And even if everybody knew which ships everybody could see, you haven't told anyone what's the first target, what's the second target, what's the third target. So it's an order that only serves to confuse the heck out of everybody. Just don't send that, or better yet, replace it with engage enemy targets as you see them and essentially make your own priority calls. And suddenly the US fire effectiveness, certainly very, very much at the beginning of the engagement, which is when it most matters, when there's the most enemy ships around, would have taken a massive leap. And, you know, combine that with, you know, actually paying attention to what the radar says and perhaps putting yourself in a slightly better position to start with. And suddenly you're going to be inflicting an awful lot more damage on the enemy. Now, will this allow you to take out Kirishima as well as Hiei? Who knows? That kind of night action, if it proved anything, is that anything and everything can and will happen at any given point in time. But just those two changes alone would have massively increased his force's effectiveness. Patrick Donnelly asks, Enterprise's last after-action report mentions that the Hellcat was becoming inadequate in dealing with kamikazes and that her VFN squadron would need Corsairs until such time as new night fighters were available. what night fighters was this report talking about? So in mid to late 1945, they were expecting the arrival of the F-7F and the F-8F. That would be the Bearcat for the F-8F and the Tigercat for the F-7F, both of which had night fighter conversions either done very shortly after they entered service or in the Tigercat's case, actually very soon into production. I think like something like the 35th, 36th aircraft of the F-7F was turned into a night fighter. Of course, there were some issues with the F-7F actually becoming a night fighter based on a carrier because of various issues it had with carrier operations. But there were a few F-7Fs actually in active operational duty from land airfields by the time the war ended, and more of them plus Bearcats were expected to come into service fairly soon. So those would be the night fighters that Enterprise was expecting to follow on. And there's some fairly good reasons why they wanted new night fighters. I mean, when you look at comparisons between the Hellcat and the Corsair could climb a lot faster. It had better power to weight ratio and it had a higher top speed than the Hellcat, especially when you're talking about relatively heavily loaded aircraft like the night fighter variants. You can see this night fighter Hellcat with its radar. But the F-7F and the F-8F were faster still. And this was the primary issue when it came to dealing with late war nighttime kamikazes. They tended to come in relatively high, which was fine. You could see them. You could send up night fighters to intercept them. But the nighttime kamikazes and torpedo bombers and so forth tended to be the slightly better Japanese aircraft, things like Judies, which were pretty darn quick. And of course, once they entered into a range where they thought they might be being intercepted by enemy night fighters, they'd go into a reasonable slope dive heading down towards their targets, which obviously augmented their already very high speed. They put pedal to the metal, engines firewalled, and suddenly it became very difficult to catch them. Neil Johnson asks, the cruiser Varjag has a memorial on the A-77 in Scotland. I saw it sunk near the memorial site, but why would a memorial site be erected to a foreign ship that's being towed for breaking and sinking? I find nothing on the site that mentions if she lost any crew in this sinking. As far as I understand it, that memorial's actually pretty recent, as in it's a 21st century memorial. And again, as I understand it, the story of Varjag in the Russo-Japanese War is seen in Russia as kind of one of the highlights of the war, in as much as there can be a highlight in a war where the Russian Navy got so thoroughly trounced, in as much as she fought against overwhelming odds and she got very badly battered for that, but she then managed to limp away and scuttle herself. Now, of course, the Japanese managed to then salvage her and bring her back into service. And then in World War One, she was sold back to Russia, which is by various steps how she ends up off the coast of Scotland. But as compared to the survivors of the 2nd Pacific Squadron, which don't end, which end up surrendering, then obviously going down by your own hands in action is kind of a bit of a step up from that. And the general action at the Battle of Tsushima is, of course, a devastating defeat, so it doesn't get celebrated quite as much. And so Varjag has this kind of, again, as I understand it in Russia, a reputation for kind of tenacity and, you know, fighting against the odds right to the bitter end. And so apparently in the early 2000s, the Russians decided they wanted to set up a memorial to this ship near where she went down. It wasn't because there was any particular number of crew on board. She was being towed to the breakers at the time. But they thought it'd be a nice thing to put a memorial up, which they then augmented, I think, because there's actually two memorials which they've set up in close proximity to each other. You know, back in the early 2000s, back when, you know, Russia was seen as sort of okay by the West. I mean, heck, to be honest, around about the time I think that memorial was being set up in the mid-2000s, I went on a field trip with my university to Russia and saw many interesting things. And I'm sure if I tried to go back there, I mean, obviously you can't at the moment directly from the UK, but even if I tried by various circuitous routes, I'm pretty sure I'd end up being chucked into prison for trying to visit half the places I visited in the mid-2000s. Classe Cornate asks, if you were given a battle group comprising of Atago as your flagship, the battleship Littorio, the carrier Victorious, and 8 Bagley-class destroyers, where in World War II can you do the most good? I think there are two potential answers to this. I mean, there's the more, you know, not esoteric, but the ones that everyone's going to reach for, assuming that this is kind of sudden teleport in, sudden strike arrival kind of stuff. There's the really obvious stuff like, you know, teleport in just north of the combined fleet right before they launch the strike on Pearl Harbor. Although you could argue that that might not actually do the most good in World War II, because if you thoroughly disrupt the strike on Pearl Harbor, then the US may not get directly involved in World War II as early as it does, which could have very interesting knock-on effects. Debate that in the comments. But in terms of, you know, what could see a rather significant reversal of fortune in a particular combat theater, I think one potential place would be, well, my personal vote would be to suddenly appear shortly before the big battle of the Java Sea in during the short-lived ABDA command's existence. You know, come in on the other side of the Japanese formation, open fire, launch airstrikes, you know, cripple the Japanese advance south. That could have some very interesting knock-on effects, because the Japanese aren't going to know what the heck's hit them. It's obviously going to save a good chunk of ABDA command's ships. You can combine with them and form a very powerful force. And if you've got, I mean, the Japanese are going to be very confused as to why Atago has a clone and that's fighting on the Allied side, but nonetheless, it's going to force the Japanese to not just have to regroup and stall their entire advance, but potentially also they're going to have to figure out, okay, what the heck do we do? You know, how many forces do we need to divert to counter this threat? And that could take quite a while. Another candidate, obviously, would be to drop in Force Z maybe a couple of hours before the Japanese bombers show up and use Victorious's aircraft and the Bagley's anti-aircraft efforts to disrupt the bomber attack, which, if you then also have accurate information, you could then lead Prince of Wales and Repulse back to where the actual invasion convoys are and shoot them up, which, I don't know, at least might delay the fall of Singapore by delaying Japanese landings in Malaya, but that's neither here nor there. Other potential candidates would be to drop these forces during the daylight part of the Battle of Cape Matapan, not for the surface combatants so much. I think Cunningham's got that pretty much covered, but Victorious would have another whole lot of strike aircraft, which potentially go after Vittorio Veneto. And if you can really cripple her, then you could potentially take out Vittorio Veneto and anyone who sticks around with her during the night, which would be a big blow to the Italian battle fleet. And of course, if you really, really want to annoy the Werribus and completely change the course of post-World War II naval discussions as to who has the best ship and all of this kind of nonsense, the other thing, of course, would be to drop this entire formation just north of Bismarck and Prince Eugen immediately before Hood and Prince of Wales hove into view during the Battle of Denmark Strait. And then, you know, Victorious launches off a quick airstrike while Atago engages Prince Eugen, Littorio engages Bismarck, the Bagley's running for a torpedo attack. The Germans are very confused as to why one of their allied battleships has suddenly shown up in the middle of the North Sea, the Atlantic, and is shooting at them. But in short, essentially, you put down Bismarck and Prince Eugen with prejudice, which not only means Hood sticks around, but it also means that Bismarck's story ends with, they tried to break out, they ran into the Royal Navy, they died horribly, the end, perhaps with some footnotes of where the heck did this clone Littorio come from. Andrew Kirschenman asks, I seem to recall someone saying the Iowas were limited in speed until the water below the keel was sufficient depth to the seafloor. Is this true? Why is it necessary? And how do they figure out the safe depth required? It is true, but it's mostly an administrative speed limit, not necessarily an actual speed limit, as in you physically can't take the ship up past a certain speed. Now, there are depths at which you definitely don't want to take an Iowa up to full speed, but those are very, very shallow depths relative to its overall draft. That's partly because as you throttle up to full speed, the stern is going to settle somewhat, and if you've only got a few feet of clearance, you could end up actually bashing the stern into the seabed, which obviously isn't good. But even if you're looking at 10, 15, 20 feet of clearance, the pressure wave of the ship advancing, plus obviously the vortexes from the propellers, can stir up a whole load of sediment, which you can then end up ingesting in the water intakes. And that is then going to really badly stuff up the ship, because you're going to get, you know, dirt and other interesting stuff in your condenser feeds and so forth, which is basically going to cripple the ship's propulsion systems. But beyond that, as the water gets deeper, you will also have, so that those are where you absolutely do not want to run up to full speed. But then beyond that, if you see one of the videos I did with Captain Sequist, you'll see actually that there is a sign in Iowa that tells you how deep the water has to be before you can go full speed. The rest of that depth is more to do with the fact, again, of the vortexes created by the propellers pushing off and A, potentially ruining the seabed, and B, kicking up huge amounts of rooster trails, which is not particularly popular, except from a visual spectacle perspective. So once you get out past that depth, then you can now do basically whatever you like. You won't end up with too many problems. How you figure out the safe depth required? Well, that's a little bit of trial and error, a little bit of calculation. And when you're at sea, in terms of figuring out that safe depth, well, you're told this is how deep the water has to be, and you use your depth sounder. You go, okay, we're beyond that. Great, fantastic. Full speed. Alternate historian Turtle Duck asks, it's time for my yearly silly question. What if, during the Anglo-German naval arms race, the Royal Navy and government become even more paranoid than Joseph Stalin was during his purges, and they don't believe that the Germans will stop building warships and are just pretending, meaning the British don't stop building, and then after World War I, they reject the Washington Naval Treaty after everybody refuses to reduce their fleet sizes. And when the Wall Street crash hits in 1929, the Royal Navy and government believe that it's a conspiracy by the Americans to weaken their naval construction capability, and all public works are to build more dry docks and warships and to keep the gun foundries in business. How would the rest of the world react to the British Empire going completely off the deep end, and would this cause a naval war before World War II? And if it doesn't, how would the Royal Navy having more ships than the US did post-1945 in 1939 affect the war? Well, the rest of the world is probably going to look at the British and go, okay, then, I guess they're keeping their top spot as the largest navy on the planet. It's going to be interesting to see how they're funding it all. But yeah, assuming that the funding is being released from the Treasury, which actually I would thoroughly love to see the Treasury meetings where presumably the First Sea Lord, you know, picks up the whoever is the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time and just, you know, does a Bane-style backbreaker on him just to emphasise the Royal Navy's dominance. Because it's going to take something along those lines to persuade the Treasury to cough up the funds. But assuming that they do this, the funny thing is, I don't think it is going to cause a naval war before World War II, simply because no one is going to try and challenge the Royal Navy at that point. So even if we assume, for the sake of argument, that the Royal Navy drops back to, rather than building 8 capital ships a year, which they were going for in the immediate run-up to World War II, and they go for 5 or 6, so a class of 4 battleships and 1 or 2 battlecruisers, which was kind of what they were going with the various 13.5-inch armed ships, for example. Well, just the 1914 plan alone gives you Renown, Repulse, and Resistance as R-class plus Agincourt. So that gives you another 4 15-inch armed battleships in addition to the historic 10 that the Royal Navy built. Of course, it denies you Renown and Repulse as battlecruisers, but 1915, by all accounts, according to some of the documentation that I've found in the archives, would probably be another set, we're going to assume 4 ships with either 16 or 16.5-inch guns. 1916, which is the period when they start building Hood, you might well see Hood, because at that point Jellicoe is going to be going like, okay, guys, seriously, we have enough battleships at the moment? But some battlecruisers would be nice. So Hood would probably be even bigger, because at that point it's not going to be, okay, well, our last battleships we built were the QEs and the Rs, so we want 8 15-inch guns. It would be the last battleships we built have 16 or 16.5-inch guns, So essentially, Hood but larger, because now 16 to 16 and a half inch guns, which would be an interesting one, to say the least. And then 1917, you get four more. 1918, you get four more. So at that point, by the time the war ends, Britain has either building or on the stocks at least 16 battleships armed with either 16 or 16 and a half inch guns, plus potentially some additional battle cruisers. Plus, of course, you've got the 14, 15 inch armed ships from the program previously, which means that in the immediate post-war environment, the Royal Navy has, again, either building or in service, at least three dozen or so super dreadnoughts of varying descriptions between battleships and battle cruisers. And that's in addition to all the 13.5-inch ships and all the 12-inch ships, which they can afford to basically scrap wholesale at that stage. And at that point, if you look at even starting from Texas and New York, and you look at, well, what does the US have in terms of 14 and 16-inch armed, in the case of the Colorado's ships, they've only got 15 ships either built or under construction, most of which are armed with 14-inch guns. So they've got less than half, which would mean that, you know, even if they commit to building six strong ship classes the way they do with the Lexingtons and the South Dakotas, even if the Royal Navy, for whatever reason, just keeps on building four ship classes, i.e. four strong ship classes, it would still take the US Navy a decade to catch up numbers-wise. And that's assuming they keep on building six ships for every four capital ships the Royal Navy lays down. That obviously, you know, the Royal Navy may choose to lay down six ships to match the Americans. They may choose to build more. And as we know, in 1921, 1922, the US government changed. They weren't so keen on building that many ships. And so if their programs get cancelled or at least severely scaled back, then the Royal Navy is just going to walk away with this ridiculous numbers advantage. But even conservatively, assuming that the Royal Navy sticks with four capital ships a year in perpetuity, effectively, then you're looking at building, obviously, 40 capital ships a decade. They're going to have a slightly more than 40 capital ships armed with 15-inch guns or larger by the end of the 1910s. And that essentially means you're going to have, for a reasonable number of ships being built, and this is assuming we're just looking at battleships and battle cruisers, we're not looking at carriers, cruisers, destroyers and all that, but let's assume they're being built in proportion, to have a fleet that is both large and modern but at least somewhat reasonable in terms of maintenance without absorbing truly insane amounts of GDP, then you're essentially looking at a roughly a 10-year life cycle for ships. So by 1921-22, the Queen Elizabeth's, well, probably the Revenge's first, but maybe, and then the Queen Elizabeth's, are going to be being cycled into reserve to maintain a fleet of probably around about 40 or so combined battleships and battle cruisers, which, to be fair, isn't necessarily that unusual, because if you look at the pre-dreadnoughts, they were operating on roughly a 10 to 12 year life cycle before they were being cycled into the reserves. Obviously, they then get brought back, a lot of them, in the First World War, but still. So you'd probably be looking at the average lifetime of a British capital ship being about 10 to 12 years on the front line, followed by maybe half a decade to a decade in reserve before both just the toll of being in reserve and the continuously advancing ever larger capital ships render them obsolete enough to be sold or scrapped. Now, as I say, this isn't necessarily completely out of context for the rest of the world, because this is essentially the British establishing the kind of fleet scale dominance over everybody else in the dreadnought period that they actually had in the pre-dreadnought period anyway. It just means that other nations that have ambitions to be the major or a major player on the world stage of watching them being a little bit curtailed, especially the Americans, who may or may not take kindly to things. But as we saw with American politics, they kind of wax and wane on how strong the Navy should be. And every time it wanes slightly, the British are just going to keep marching forwards. And if they've got you know, as I say, roughly 40 ships in their fleet and another 40 in reserve. I think even the most hawkish American politician is going to look at it and go, there is no way we're catching up at that point. Although it would be quite amusing to watch the Japanese nosedive their economy into the ground in the 1920s in an even vague attempt to try and not match, but at least have something that might deter such a massive doom fleet. But again, if we assume that Britain is building its carriers, cruisers, destroyers, submarines, etc. proportionally to all of this, and somehow finding all the money to pay for it, then that means in the run-up to World War II, if you include the stuff that's held in ready reserve, i.e. ships that are less than 20 years old but have been paid off into the reserves to just so the regular battle fleet is running about 40 capital ships and associated vessels at any given time, you're looking at a Royal Navy that's about five times the size of the Royal Navy that enters World War II historically, possibly slightly larger. And at that point, if Britain turns around and says, oi, knock it off, Hitler, Hitler kind of has to respect that because, you know, the Royal Navy as existed in 1939, okay, fair enough, there was no real chance for the Kriegsmarine to directly attack it, but you had things like the U-boat war potentially and keeping the British off balance, especially if you can ally with Italy or you can get them involved in a three-way war between Germany, Italy and Japan. In this scenario, if Britain has five, six times the number of destroyers and escorts and so forth that it did historically, the U-boat war is basically dead on arrival because Britain can almost carpet the Western approaches and the channel with destroyers just to stop the U-boats ever getting anywhere. And the fact you have to split your attention between Germany and Italy is going to be basically a non-problem. You just go, oh yeah, sure, fine. We'll leave 10 capital ships in British waters. We'll send 20 capital ships to the Mediterranean. We've got another 10, oh, I don't know, we'll send another 10 to Japan, to Hong Kong or Singapore to deter the Japanese while we drag everyone out of reserve. And then once we've dragged them out of reserve, we'll send another 20, so we'll have a 30-strong fleet in Singapore, to which the Japanese Navy is going to go, well, what do you expect us to do now? And then you go, oh, yeah, well, we've got another 20 left, so let's throw another 10 into the home fleet. And I don't know, we want to go and shoot up. Who are we going to shoot up with the remaining 10? I don't know. We'll keep them on ready reserve for whenever we need them. It's just a complete surfeit of ridiculousness. Quite where they're finding the crew for all this. I don't know. The Royal Navy becomes the single largest employer in the entire country, but it would be very, very amusing. No one's going to bother challenging a naval power of that scale because at that scale, you could literally fight the combined naval effort against the Axis single-handedly and, you know, destroy the various enemy fleets in detail. And at that point, Churchill's ideas of taking some older ships, fitting them up with a bunch of blisters and sailing them into enemy harbours to shoot up the place on principle is actually viable because they're not going to miss them. And on that admittedly silly note, it's time to end this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.